Good evening. This is the NLA Hamsnet. We talk about all things NLA-ish and hamish, or both-ish. We welcome everybody. Everyone is willing that is willing can participate. These are recorded, and they're up on the NLA website, nationallibertyalliance.org. Look for COS, and then look for the ham communications. My name is Terry from Colorado. I am K-I-0-R-E. I'm an extra class ham, amateur extra ham, have been for several years. And I had a question put to me before the recording started tonight, and that is it really a good idea to get your license? And I would like to address this in, I think, at least two different ways. One is that, especially on the HF band, your radio signal goes or can go around the world. And because of that, that frequency may be used by a lot of different people in different countries. For instance, the line A in the northern United States, you can't operate between 420 and 430 megahertz because those frequencies are used in Canada for either EMT or search and rescue operations. And so if you use those, you have the potential of creating interference with their really serious activities. So the first one is that when you send out a signal, that could go anywhere to anybody. And that's a good thing to remember because you never know who's listening out there. So that's number one. Number two, we have a lot of hams that help each other, and they have clubs, and they do things, and they're all licensed because that's all they know, and I think that's good. If you look at the ham bands through in the ham in the radio frequency spectrum, they're these tiny little slivers. I used to have an example here in the book, but there's these tiny little slivers of allocation. For instance, your FM radio stops at about 108 megahertz, and then from 108 up to about 136 megahertz is aircraft frequencies. That's what the air traffic control system uses. And then from there, I don't know what's on 136 to 144, but at 144 to 148 megahertz, that's a ham set of frequencies. Then you go from 148 past some news channel things, some multi-use radio signals, GRS, FRS, and on up to the lower part of the ham band at 420, there's military in there. There's a lot of stuff. I guess 220 is the next ham band. And there's a lot of things in there, including when you have these little boxes and you're listening to the weather radio, that's on about 162.5 megahertz. So there's a lot of stuff out there. You have ship-to-shore frequencies. You have frequencies that just go all over the world. So the hams are going to be listening on certain frequencies. Now, if you had every frequency, you're just splitting the time that you have to spend listening to every other frequency that's not in a ham band. So I'm kind of grateful that they made this and made what's called a band plan. And it just says that we're going to allocate this for amateur radio, and this for emergency stuff, and this for cities, and this for something else. And they basically follow that. They split the world into three parts, and it's the International, the French for the International Telegraphic Telecommunications Union. And I can't pronounce it. I haven't looked at it in a while, so I don't even know what to say. But there's three regions, 1, 2, and 3. We're in ITU Region 2. And the countries in each of those regions have signed an agreement to keep these bands clear and only use these bands here. And they got pretty much that's where it was finally codified and defined what our ham bands would be. In the beginning, you could be on any frequency you want. And as a matter of fact, there's been many hams that have assisted in rescue operations on the deep sea because they were listening on all these different frequencies. It wasn't until the 19-teens and 1920s that they really started, it started to get crowded in the ham bands, or not the ham bands, but all radio frequencies. And add to that somebody experimenting might not even know what they're doing. So if you know what you're doing and you can do it, I'm not going to give you permission to do it because I don't have the authority to do that. But you could, it's just like making a U-turn where you're not supposed to. Yeah, you can get away with it. But who knows if somebody's not out there listening or watching, you do it. At one time, all we had was spark gap. And spark gap means that I take something like a Tesla coil and I ramp up the voltage so it'll jump across a spark. And I put the gap very close. And when I key down, it jumps across the spark. When I unkey, it's not. And so they would send Morse code using a spark gap. Well, anybody that knows anything about the electrical properties, like Jan, of electromagnetic waveforms, that spark gap is a square wave. It's either there or it's not. And the way you produce a square wave is to have all the odd multiples of a whole set of frequencies across the spectrum. So a spark gap transmitter really just floods everything. You can receive a spark gap transmission from anywhere, and it has been done. And you can even be not on the same frequency, it'll still do it because it's just such a noisy apparatus. Well, as they design tubes, as they following that, design transistors and diodes, got the antennas got better, the different circuits that they use. There's a Class A, a Class B, and a Class C amplifier. And one of them, the Class C amplifier is just, it doesn't produce a really good wave, a representation of what it sounds like. But the Class A does really well. And then you got receivers. So in the beginning, you had to have lots of power. You couldn't go more than a few miles, even with the best receivers. And if you look up on the net, you'll see some of the Navy receivers, which were state-of-the-art at the time. They're the size of a Volkswagen and maybe as tall as 8 feet high. And that's what they used for the amplification. And the thing was water-cooled or oil-cooled. And it was tough. Well, they got better and better. And what I'm saying is that not everybody understands what radio waves are. And if we just allowed anybody to make anything they wanted, we would endlessly be looking for an open band, and then your receiver would have to be an open band. At least having the ham bands, you know where to be listening. I can scan the frequencies between 144 and 148 a lot faster than I can between 108 megahertz all the way up to 450 megahertz or even more than that. Does that make any sense, what I just said? And do I need to clarify?
This is KC3HVA. Just to add a little something, since I've done most of my work in acoustics. When you're working in a small confined volume like a pond or a swimming pool or a little test basin and you want to get precise timing, a spark gap is a great way to do it. And it's executed underwater. It creates a Dirac delta, essentially. Infinite or near infinite rise time so that you can measure a timing effects very accurately. Same as you did with electromagnetic waves.
I did not know that. That's very good. Did I answer your question, sir?
Greg.
Greg, did I answer your question, Greg?
Yes, thank you very much. Back to you.
So it's a lot easier to go ahead and stay with what we have until we don't need it anymore, so to speak. And at that point, you'll be able to do just about what you want with it, and then we'll have chaos again. By making these rules, the FAA is just instituting what worldwide we realized, that if everybody's on the same band, nobody's going to be able to communicate. You need a clear channel to be able to get a communication, a message across to whoever you're communicating with. And we can't do that if everybody's on all the frequencies all the time. So I'll leave that to you. Okay. Do we have any other questions? That was interesting. I appreciate the question. Okay, we left off at page 3-13 in the ARRL Ham Radio License Manual, Level 1 Technician. And there in the middle where it says Schematics and Component Symbols.
Do you have the URL for that?
I'm sorry?
Do you have the URL or the link for that?
I don't know that it has a URL. I'm looking at the paper copy here.
Oh, okay.
I don't know that they sell it in any other way. So I'm just going through that. We talked last week about switches and how to turn power on and off and relays. And then it gets in, on page 314, there's a whole schematic symbols used in circuit diagrams. And you just got to look at them and get used to them, because there's no better way to lay out what a circuit looks like than to put it in a schematic, so that other people can understand. And there's some schematics on the next page, 3-15, that show this tube hooked up to this transformer, and it's got this transistor and a light and different stuff. There's an antenna tuner where it has two capacitive circuits with a inductor in the middle that are all adjustable. And you can adjust to what you need to match the antenna to the output of your radio. So I really can't say much about that, because you kind of got to look at it. But I can tell you that if you get familiar with all the stuff that's on page 3-14 on the top section there in that figure 3.15, you will be able to read schematics. Now, there's a little more to it than that, of course, but at least you know that if there's a diode right here, they expect the electricity in that circuit to be flowing along that path in one direction, and it blocks it in the other direction. So you know something about that circuit right off. If you look at a transistor, there's NPNP and NPN. There's a base emitter and a collector. Your current usually travels between the collector and emitter, and it's controlled by the base. So whatever you have coming in on the base is your main signal that you're trying to amplify. And a tiny little signal on the base into a transistor will create a large change in the current between the emitter and the collector, depending upon whether you got a PNP or NPN transistor, which means the flow of the electrons is from one way to the other. Then there's a P-channel MOSFET FET field effect transistor and a P-channel. I don't know much about them. I've used them, but I am really worried about them because I, by the time I started having kids and everything, I didn't have time to fiddle with electricity after that. There's a whole bunch of inductors and capacitors. And by looking at these and knowing these schematic diagrams for each part, you kind of begin to see. And if it says this transistor is Q1, oftentimes you can look on the board, and to aid in identification, they print Q1 on the board. So you go down to Q1, and you say, it's that transistor right here. I should have that signal on the base of that transistor. Do I? Yes, I have a tiny little signal. I have to really amplify it to hear it. Do I have it on the collector or emitter of that circuit? No, I do not. Well, there's the bad part. Okay. Now, I'm oversimplifying, and I'll just go on. All right, if you have any questions, please jump in, because I'm putting this together from the book, and some people don't understand. And Jen, you're welcome to jump in just whenever you want.
Okay.
Let's see, 3.3, types of radios and radio circuits on page 3-16. In the early days, the radio amateurs used separate transmitters and receivers. And that lasted, I mean, they started doing it all in the same box, but that lasted. You bought a transmitter, or you built a transmitter, or you bought a receiver. And you'd listen on one and transmit on the other. And a switch was used to connect the antenna to either the transmitter or the receiver. And this is, as you might imagine, the circuit was called a transmit-receive switch, or a TR switch. The TR switch is still present in today's transceivers in an internal circuit. And I'm here to tell you that is still true. And there's a little figure, 3.17, and it shows a... my eyes are being screwy here. It looks like an oscillator. I can't tell. Where's my magnifying glass?
Yes, it's an oscillator.
Hey, say what?
It's an oscillator driving a driver to a power amp with a telegraph key across the driver and the power amp.
Yeah. And so there you go. That's a simple CW transmitter. And then we get into filters right after that. The oscillator, you got to have an oscillator that's vibrating or changing the circuit at the frequency you want to transmit or near the frequency you want to transmit at, or you can't really drive it and get the full power out, and you won't be on the right frequency. And so it has to tell you, so there's a lot of feedback. And I'm not going to go over that, but I do want to talk about filters. Filters are the kind of thing that are really cool. They tend to either let a certain band pass through the filter, which is called a band pass filter, and then they block. So there's a high pass filter, and a high pass filter means that the higher frequencies will go through, but your lower frequencies are shorted to ground, shunted to ground. And so the high frequency is the only thing going out. It's not generating any low frequencies. A bandpass filter, it just has a narrow range or maybe a little wider range that it only lets a certain frequency through. That's a bandpass. A low-pass filter means that all the low frequencies will come through, but anytime you have something higher than a certain frequency, it just kills it, shunts it right to ground. Well, how can that shunt to ground? You use what's called an LC circuit. You use inductance and capacitance, either hooked in series or hooked in parallel. And when you hit a resonant frequency or those, or even close to those, it will either let it pass or it will shunt it to ground. So, if you put it across the leads, it's shunted. If you put it in series, it only lets certain things pass. And this brings me to something that you see up on antennas, some ham antennas, these large high-frequency antennas that are actually very low frequencies from our standpoint here. They go all around the world, and you'll look and you'll see these little wide spots on some of the elements, maybe all of the elements. And it may have one of these wide spots or two of these wide spots. They're like a little cylinder on this nice, clean, beautiful antenna. You got this little cylinder hanging out there. It might be 8, 9, 10, 12 inches long. And inside that is a filter. And at a certain frequency, that filter blocks, and you use it makes it look like to the transmitter and the receiver as a shorter antenna. And then on lower frequencies, it lets it pass. So you have a low-pass filter in there, or maybe you have a notch filter or whatever you have. And you get the benefits of having a longer antenna. And that's a really cool trick that I was just dumbfounded when I found that out, that you could do that. The last thing, let's see, we talked about high-pass filters, band-pass filters, and low-pass filters. The other one is a notch filter. And a notch filter says, I want to reject this frequency right here. I don't want that frequency in my radio or going out my antenna or coming into my finals or whatever it's coming in, my detector. And so it'll pass low frequencies, it'll pass high frequencies, but it won't pass on the frequency that you have. Some of these are done with cans, and the cans act as a bandpass or a notch filter, depending on how you have it tuned. And it just goes into a resonant cavity, and that resonant cavity is tuned very close to what frequency you want it to be. And there's an adjustment on that. You can tune them across different frequencies. And they're fun to look at. You take the top off, and there's a little screw that you can turn while it's outside before you take the top off. And it just takes a little probe and puts it in and out or moves the height of the end down. But you look into it, and it's a tall cylinder. It might be 3 feet high, and there's nothing in it. It's all bare metal. And yet when you put that in there, there's a tiny little, I forget what they call them. They're a twisted delta shape, like a shark tooth, only twisted even more than a shark tooth. And they put a signal in there, and whatever that cavity is tuned to, you get that one specific frequency out. What is that good for? Well, if you've got a high place like we have here in Colorado where you can put up a 100-foot tower or a 20-foot tower, doesn't matter, and if you're on top of a mountain, it works really well because you get the effect of the mountain, and the mountain might be at 5,000 feet roughly, and the mountain might be at 11,000 feet. So I get 6,000 feet of tower for free along the Front Range. Well, that's a distinct advantage. And so you put your antenna up there. Well, everybody wants that advantage. So they put several repeaters up there. Well, you don't want any of them interfering with anybody else. So what you do is you put these cans to filter out any frequencies except the one for your, the two for your repeater. Works very well. Let's see. Moving on, any questions?
No, that was explained very well.
Oh, thank you. Okay, we've got about 20 minutes, I figure. Modulators. The process of combining data or voice signals with an RF signal is modulation, as you learned earlier. So a circuit that performs modulation function is therefore called a modulator. Now, this is very important. CW means continuous wave. So when you hear code, what you're hearing is whether the signal is there or it's not there. So when you hear a tone, deep, 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 when you hear a tone, deep, the signal is there. when you don't hear a tone, the signal, the carrier, isn't even there. And that's what CW is, continuous wave. You interrupt the continuous wave and turn it into dips and dashes. And that's how you're modulating. You're modulating it with your hand. Let's just take the case of a person with a ham radio and a key, a keyer. As he moves his hand or she moves her hand, she makes the dits and the dahs the appropriate length. And as long as everybody is using the same code, you can communicate. And that will go a long, long ways. It'll go all the way around the world. Well, we got better and better, and now we can do voice all over everywhere. And it's not as important to learn code as much. As a matter of fact, they dropped the requirements for code. Used to, you had to be able to transmit and receive at 20 words per minute to get your extra class. Well, the only reason I got my extra, I couldn't do code that fast because I learned it as a kid, and I learned that A is da-da instead of having somebody type it to me so that I never looked at it. And I can say that if you start trying to find what the Morse code is, you might have trouble finding copies. Now with the Internet, it's pretty easy, but it's amazing how hard it was for me to find a copy. But my dad brought home a copy, and I didn't think anything about it, and I started learning Morse code by looking at the characters. Well, that's my upper-level brain doing that. Much better way. Don't even look at it. Have somebody type you an A, da-da, on a key, a code key that you can get at many different places. I'll leave that up to you. They're about $30. You can get them online. MFJ is a manufacturer that I've used many, many times. I've got two of them over in a box right behind me. And so you get that da-da, and you hear it, and you write an A down. And you do that. And you put in another letter and another letter and another letter, and week to week, you get more and more letters so you have the whole alphabet. And then you do your numbers. Then you do your special characters. And you get an ability to write down those. Just hearing it, you'll write down what letter it was. You're developing neural pathways from your auditory area in your brain directly to the muscles in your hand to copy code. And if you do it like that, you can go as fast as you want. I know guys that they can keep up with two or three conversations at 40 and 50 words per minute without a problem because it's coming so fast that it's like reading. And they hear it. They know these words. And they can tell you what every one of the different ones we're talking about. And it's going, unbelievable, unbelievable. But I didn't learn it that way. I said, an A is did-da, B is da-did-did-did. And I just learned that. And that's okay when you're doing a flashlight to somebody because you're having to look at it. You're not listening to it. But when we did Bark Juniors, we would sit and type for about 30 minutes to the Bark Juniors, and we'd introduce another letter every week and just sit there and get it so that when they heard it, they wrote it down, and then it becomes second nature. It's second nature. You don't have to think about what word somebody just said. You already know what it is. Well, that's the pathway that code, Morse code, really uses when you get good at it, CW. Okay, that's one way of modulating, and I won't go into a whole bunch more, but that's one way of modulation. All the modulations up above that do different things, and the ones that you hear about most are amplitude modulation. So they put signal on the amplitude of the signal, the actual information. So there's many, many fluctuations that, you know, your sine wave is going up and down much more frequently than that little information of, like a radio signal, like AM radio. That's amplitude modulated radio. All of your, or not all, but most of your aviation band radios are amplitude modulated. And so they're modulating the amplitude and that your information is on that modulated signal going up and down a certain height. You put a diode in there, you get half of it. You take out the original frequency, and you've got your audio signal right there. FM is, well, we had a different term. It's fine magic. It's actually called frequency modulation. And what they're doing there is for everything that you hear, they modulate in the frequency. So it takes a little bit more bandwidth, but the variation of the frequency in there. The nice thing about FM is it rejects all the noise that you normally hear from lightning strikes or running down the highway with the power lines going under them. And so you get a nice, clear signal. The signal is either there or isn't. And if it's way back and you can hear static over it, that means you've got an extremely weak signal. And you can tell by whether you have noise in an FM signal, how strong that FM signal is. What are some other ways? Well, they get pretty bizarre. And I would point you towards the software-defined radio, SDR, and some of the things you can do. The GNU Radio Project is all free. And for $20, you can get a little dongle that plugs into your USB port and turns your computer into a receiver. And then everything it does to process that is done on the computer using the software-defined radio. And you can get pretty bizarre. And you would not believe how many ways you can modulate a signal and carry different information on there, either analog or binary. Both AM and FM are analog signals. You can get into a point where you have like 16 channels one way and 16 channels the other way, and it hops among the frequencies. And that's a digital form of modulation. It's sending bits out. And it gets really bizarre real fast, and it's amazing. So I'll just leave that there. There's different ways of modulating a straight CW-type signal, which is just a carrier wave. It's a sine wave. What modulation you use on the transmitter or is used on the transmitter, you have to have the same demodulation on your receiver or you can't hear it. Okay, now how do some of these mixers, it talks about a mixer. A mixer is closely related to a modulator. Both types of circuits combine signals with the antenna producing an output signal with a different frequency. The mixer, however, is designed to combine two RF signals and shift one of them to a third frequency. It does not combine an RF signal with a data or voice signal like a modulator does. Mixers are used in both transmitters and receivers to shift signal frequencies for various purposes. And it shouldn't be confused with an audio mixer. In the receiver, if we include mobile phones, the most widely used type of receiver today is called a direct conversion receiver. Direct conversion receivers use mixers to convert an modulated signal directly back to speech or data. If the modulating signal is digital data, the output of the mixer is converted back to data using digital signal processing, DSP techniques. Getting really deep in here. What I do want to do is go down the next paragraph. It says the super heterodyne receiver uses mixers to shift incoming signals of any frequency to a single fixed frequency, i.e., when you tune your main receiver to a particular frequency, it automatically tunes a mixer circuit to 10.4 megahertz off of that circuit, so that going from your receiver into your signal processing portion of your transmitter It's always on 10.6 megahertz. On AM, I think it's 540 kilohertz. I don't know about those anymore. I.e., that way, everything downstream in your receiver only works on one frequency. It doesn't have to deal with the whole range of frequencies. So when you tune a receiver, often what you're doing is you're retuning two different oscillators, one for the primary frequency that you're listening on, and a second for one that is the what they call the intermediate frequency away from it. So like on an FM signal on 144 megahertz, 10.4 down from that is what, 133.4 megahertz. So you actually have two oscillators in there, one running at 144 megahertz, one running at 133.4. And the difference will be, coming out of a mixer, is 10.4 or 10.6. And that's exactly what most FM circuits, at least when I was growing up, that's exactly what they use. Maybe it's changed now. I don't know. It's kind of confusing. It works better if you map it out. But it was because of the super heterodyne circuit that we now have all of these communications. Before, you had to have headphones, and the headphones weren't that good. And so if you had a really distant signal, everybody was using AM modulation. If you had a really distant signal, it was very hard to hear. You couldn't get the amplification where you needed it. Nothing like what you can do today. You can run your TV up to 100%, and it's blowing your doors off. You couldn't do that back then. Whatever the signal was coming in as, that's about all you had, and it went to a set of headphones because that's the only thing that it could move. If you tried to use that to drive a speaker, you got nothing. And the super heterodyne receiver uses mixers to shift incoming frequencies of any frequency to a single fixed frequency called the intermediate frequency, or IF, where unwanted signals are rejected by filters. So they trim all the filters to that one intermediate frequency. After amplification filtering at the IF, the signal is then demodulated. So super heterodyne techniques are also used to construct transmitters. Essentially, the process of mixer, filter, amplify, demodulate is run in reverse to create a transmitter. This is just how many modern transceivers are constructed, using clever switching schemes to reuse many of the same circuits on both receive and transmit. Okay, my computer is locked up. I should reboot it. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Okay. I've got, about 6 minutes, seven minutes? I want to do the selectivity and sensitivity. Receivers are compared on the basis of two primary characteristics, the sensitivity and the selectivity. A receiver's sensitivity determines its ability to detect signals. So your sensitivity tells you how weak the signal can be and you still can hear it. A receiver's sensitivity detects it. Higher sensitivity means the receiver can detect weaker signals. Sensitivity is specified as a minimum detectable signal level, usually in microwave volts. So it's a mu, the letter mu, which is looks like a U only with the front leg extending below. It's a Greek letter. And then a V for volts, microvolts. If a receiver is not sensitive enough, a preamplifier or preamp can be used. The preamp is connected between the antenna and the receiver. Selectivity is the ability of a receiver to discriminate between signals, retrieving only the information from the desired signal in the presence of unwanted signals. High selectivity means that a receiver can operate properly even in the presence of strong signals on nearby frequencies. Receivers use filters to reject the unwanted signals. And then the last thing I got on there, and I'll try and wrap it up, is transverters. And I forget what a transverter is. Let's read. The super heterodyne technique of shifting signal frequencies can also be applied to the equipment level to convert an entire transceiver to operate on a band other than it was designed for. Instead of a mixer, a piece of equipment called a transverter is used. Low-power transmitter outputs signals on one band are shifted to the new output frequency where they are amplified for transmission. A receiving converter, basically a mixer, shifts incoming signals down to the desired. I don't see many of those, but I'm sure they're very, very useful. And it uses the example here that a few transceivers available for CW and single sideband operation on 220 megahertz, a transverter is used to convert 220 megahertz signals to and from the 28 megahertz band available in all HF gear. So, in other words, you can talk on a little bit higher or lower frequency with a transverter and still use your old radio. Excuse me. I've covered a lot of stuff here, and we're just up to page 3-19, and that's the end of that. That's the end of Chapter 3, and we're on to Chapter 4 next week. So does anybody have any questions or anything they'd like to say, criticism, comments, please call now. Well, I hope everyone had as much fun listening to that. You're on the receiving side, and I was on the transmitting side, if you will. And I enjoyed giving it because I like to teach. And I hope it is good for some people. Get a hold of the book if you can and take a look at these things. The only way you're going to get your ham license is to read up, learn a few things, and it's not hard. Take a 35-question test, get 26 of them right. They're all multiple choice. And this book I'm reading from, every question that you're going to see is in that book. They have about 400 questions. They take 35 at a time. They put it on a test, and they let you answer it. And then once you have a license, you can talk on anything from 220 on up. So that's pretty good. No, I think you can do 30 meters too, as a matter of fact, which is the top of the HF band. So I would encourage you to do it. Do you need a license? No, you don't. Could you communicate without a license? You bet. And if that's how you want to prepare, fine. But I think there's a whole range of skills that you need to develop that are associated with communicating over radio. You have to develop an ear so you understand what somebody else is saying. You have to be able to learn to know how to use your equipment so you have the best chance of making that communication that's so critical. And you have to have that right equipment. And so you find with the equipment that you like to use and that works for you, essentially. So, if there are no other questions, anyone got any call now? Statements, comments, whatever. Then I'll go ahead and close that. Thank you, everybody, very much for your participation and listening tonight. Jen, I appreciate your input. That was excellent. This is Terry in Colorado. I am KI0RE. You can look me up on QRZ.com and see who I am. And this net is held every Wednesday night at 8 p.m. Eastern Time. We invite anybody that wants to talk about the NLA or HAMS or Committees of Safety or anything like that to please come on and talk. And I could use more hams if you want to contribute and teach a lesson. That's great. And I will just continue going through the book as best I can. I know I'm not perfect, but I sure hope everybody can use it. The idea is that to really get a license, so you can cooperate and begin to learn how to use the discipline and be able to get along well with it, you need to get the book, or you need to look on the net, on the internet, and start learning, and then go take the test. And then you're open and free and clear, and you know what you can and can't do. And I encourage you to make contact with your local hams, get you a ham mentor called an Elmer, and do what it takes. So, with all that said, thank you very much, and the net is now closed.